Just before we kick off today's installment of the podcast, I want to take a minute to say that this is the 50th episode to be released. I want to take the opportunity to thank everybody involved, but in particular, all the incredible guests we've had on. Hopefully you found the show entertaining and informative with plenty of insights from the broad spectrum of careers and life stories that we've featured. Please do like, share and subscribe so that we can look forward to another 50 episodes. Thanks for listening. Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. Tomás O'Leary is a visionary leader driving transformation in the software industry. As the founder and CEO of Origina, he has revolutionized independent software maintenance, providing enterprise customers with a reliable alternative to vendor support. Origina is a software maintenance vendor and are the independent software maintenance and support provider that pairs their clients with dedicated global IBM, HCL and VMware product experts who keep a perpetual eye on performance, longevity and compliance of the enterprise software estate. They support large organizations, with complex IBM environments that need to modernize and grow and take care of interoperability, licensing and security so customers can dedicate their time and budget to moving forward. Tomás leads with a bold vision uniting innovation, advocacy and sustainability to create meaningful change in the enterprise software market. Since founding the company in 2012, he has positioned it as a global leader, empowering organizations to break free from vendor lock-in and unlock greater value from their software investments. Tomás, you are very welcome to the podcast. I hope I got everything there now, did I?
God, I think that sounds like my website.
Could well be. You're letting people know where I get all my research on. Right, starting point here. Why don't you tell me in layman's terms what Origina does and how it's different from what's already out there?
Yeah, that's a good question. We're IT services is what we provide, support, to technical debt is what's kind of the jargon that's often used. And what is technical debt? It is the technology that organizations have and have invested in for many years that probably consumes half their budget to just keep the lights on and another 30 to 40% potentially to actually do iterative changes to it, okay? Most companies are spending 90% of their budget, according to the likes of Gartner, on just keeping things moving forward. We help people unlock that. Now, the problem exists mostly in the very, very large companies because smaller companies have a little bit more agility. So those numbers and those percentages would be different. So we started this business back in 2012 with, from day one, deciding we were going to be a global company. Actually, one of our first customers was down in Australia, Rio Tinto.
Right.
You know, so, and we decided we would only target the biggest companies in the world. I mean, at the moment, for example, when we do, we estimate the average revenue of our customers, and it's not always possible because some of them are public sector organizations like NASA, can measure their revenue. But if, where we can measure revenue, their $20 billion is the average revenue of the customers. If, I know revenue is not always the big sole determinant of the success of a business, but it's a kind of a nice benchmark. So huge organizations who've got an enormous challenge. You know, you could take a typical organization that might have, a typical customer of ours might have a $10 billion a year IT spend. Imagine $5 billion of that is actually spent on just keeping things alive, right? Just keeping things going. About potentially $3 to $4 billion more is on what I would describe as unnecessary changes. So what is an unnecessary change? An unnecessary change is where you're making a change to technology. It's like an unnecessary change often is what we when we change our phone. We see it as consumers. the reality is, if I change my phone, I'm on, I don't know, maybe I'm on iPhone 12, let's say, or whatever number. The latest is 15 or 16. I'm not really going to see anything different. Okay?
Yeah, you're not going to use the phone any differently.
I'm not going to use, in fact, I'll still have more apps on it. So it's actually almost a waste. The only issue is the battery degrades. Now, it is known that there's the forced obsolescence and built-in obsolescence exists in all parts of technology. It is even worse in large enterprises. And we help organisations unpick that, and that's what we do. So I think in your summary, somewhere along the way, is that we allow them look forward and look ahead and not be worried about the past.
And is it the case that they just can't get rid of these systems, that it's so ingrained in the business that, you know, to basically throw it all out and bring it up to a, you know, a SaaS-based model or whatever they're looking to do, that it's just not possible for them to do it?
Well, it's not necessary.
Okay.
I mean, I recently did up a house. The house was built in 1870-something. Mm-hmm. I didn't throw every single part of the house out. Whether I was entitled, it wasn't a protected structure, so I could have probably knocked the whole thing down and rebuilt it. Mm-hmm. But I didn't. You don't need to.
Yeah.
It would have cost me more money, probably. So we see this in our everyday lives, but organisations come along, in the tech world, what it's like is if they come along and they put the plumbing into your house. And then actually what happens is they tell you when you need to change your plumbing, not you, or your boiler, or your heating system. They also tell you who can repair it and when it can be repaired, and they dictate the price that you pay. And every few years they change the name of the boiler to a different name, to another three-letter acronym, to tell you that it's really something more sophisticated, when you're actually not getting anything
more
different.
Yeah.
There's a classic example happening now, which is happening, and even though they're probably not the worst offender, Microsoft Windows 10 to Windows 11, they've supported it for a very long period of time, and now organisations finally are going to have to get off with Windows 10 to Windows 11. There's absolutely no reason for most companies to do that. But the issue is, because we're an independent provider, okay? So we're not affiliated with
any. You don't have a dog in the fight, as they say.
Well, we're not affiliated. We deliberately are independent to the vendors. When you come to us, you do not have access to the publishers. So it's IBM or it's HCL, because the reason it's HCL, by the way, you may remember a product, Lotus Notes.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, well, IBM bought it. It was a Boston-based company. And then ultimately they sold it in 2018. Believe it or not, there's still people using it, a lot of people using it, to HCL. HCL have a software division. Okay. They're mostly in the kind of IT services space, but they have a software division. So they sold for 1.8 billion, I think, or something along those lines, back in 2018. We have recently moved into the VMware space. Now, when we started this business in 2012, talk about technical debt, VMware would not have been technical debt.
No.
It was kind of 2012. It'd been around maybe 10 years at that stage, maybe a bit more. And it had been, it was like the engine for cloud computing.
Yeah.
You know, it was the kind of early engine for cloud computing. So it's a really important tool. But now move on 10 years since we started, you know, actually 13 years since we started the business. VMware now is actually technical debt. So much so that the graveyard for technical debt, the organization loves buying them, Broadcom, buy them for 60-odd billion from Dell in 2023. And actually then immediately, because they can, change the whole terms and conditions. Tell our customers, for example, in most cases, that actually you actually now no longer, you can keep the version you have and the product you have. You own the rights to use it, but we're not going to support it anymore.
Right.
You're going to have to buy our rented version, the cloud version, which is just a rental model.
Yeah.
So it's like you have a car outside, you go, whatever car you drive, let's say if you're lucky, it's a BMW or a Mercedes or something like that, right? So, or it's a Toyota perhaps. So you have that car and all of a sudden, Toyota or BMW or Mercedes say to you, actually, we're not going to service that car anymore. And by the way, if you want a car from us, you can't buy a car anymore. You can only rent it.
Yeah.
And the rental cost, we've jacked that up.
Yeah.
And in some cases, by hundreds of percent. And I'm going, nobody is even talking about this. Because who has ever heard of VMware?
Yeah.
You mentioned it, you'd heard of it.
Yeah.
What is it? It's a hypervisor. I mean, honestly, who's ever heard of a hypervisor?
It's not something for the car, I can tell you.
But these guys spend $64 billion on a hypervisor. Why? Yeah. Because it's got long-term license revenue
and a huge install base.
Well, also because nobody's doing anything about this.
Yeah.
Nobody.
Yeah.
And people are, I mean, I run a non-profit. That's where I was yesterday. I came back this morning from the UK. We had a board meeting. I run a non-profit out of Brussels called Free ICT. And a similar organisation I've set up in Washington. We tell legislators about what's going on. And they're kind of, we're just about the consumer. The consumer is 28%, according to IDC, of all the IT spend. There's $5 trillion spent on IT globally that has nothing to do with the consumer. And what are they doing about it? Nobody's doing anything about it. Yeah. But the reality, it's actually not... I don't blame legislators, to be honest with you. It's businesses.
Yeah.
It's actually...
Inertia.
It's boards. Yeah. It's CEOs. Have actually hired CEOs. I'm a CEO. I have to know what my IT guys are doing. Mm. I can't just go, better give them more money. Mm. And they come in and give me some gobbledygook about cloud or AI or machine learning before it was AI. You know, I mean, I have to understand what the hell are we doing, because it's critical to my business. I want to get competitive advantage from it. I want to do things faster. I want to see, can I bring products to market, services to market faster? That's what we all want to do. We don't want to get caught up with, we have to do the upgrade of this to that, and that'll take about 18 months, and let us come back to you when we're done, and then we'll talk about what you want to do. We'll give you some money.
Yeah.
We'll give you some effort. What are you talking about? That's why you have Larry Ellison outside the White House.
Mm.
Honestly, that's why he's there.
The Oracle database is there.
But it should be gone long ago.
Yeah.
It should have been gone. It's there because they've locked everybody in.
Yeah.
And the beautiful, perfect lock-in was the cloud.
Because
once you rent something from somebody...
Yeah, you can never leave.
Well, it's very hard. You can leave, to be fair. There are ways around this.
Yeah.
But people are having to create, there's divisions in all our customers. They have what they call as vendor management divisions.
Mm-hmm.
So these in IT, these are professionals, they're experienced, they go to conferences and they study how to be a vendor manager to protect the company, the company, who's the customer, mm-hmm. from the predatory behaviours of the vendor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... Where does that happen? You know, imagine we're walking down Grafton Street and I'm your vendor manager and I've got to stop them throwing stuff at you before you go into the shop.
Yeah.
You know, or beating you up out in the street. I mean, and I'm not saying it's that bad, but this is the stuff that happens in our industry. So now, what does that got to do with Origina? It's probably a question one might ask. Well, not a lot at the moment, because we're a company that started in 2012. Our first customer was in 2015. One of our earliest customers, I mentioned, was in Australia. We've helped over nearly 250 organisations globally unpick some of this. I'm not saying we're perfect, but we're on a journey. We've taken it from a standing start, never took anybody's money. In fact, I owed money when we started the business. I had to figure out how to unpick a loan. A loan I'd taken from Anglo-Irish Bank that ended up in IBRC and then ended up in a vulture fund, and I had to unpick it. So we had no money, I had minus money, and we've now created a business with a super team. Myself and Rowan built it from scratch. We had a small team initially, brought in some outstanding people into the business from all over the world. Here in Ireland, and we have an office now in Plano, Texas. We're at 50 million last year, at the end of October. We'll do 70 million this year, and we'll do 100 million probably the year after. We haven't bought a company. All we've done is done growth. But we are not, we're like a still a kind of an ant on an ant compared to the size of the industry. I actually think there's an opportunity for us if we could get people talking about this. Business leaders, so people that listen to your show, people you have on your show to talk about this, say the opportunity here is not that IT is bad. IT is outrageously good.
Yeah.
It has delivered some of the most amazing things to all our lives. The issue is there's parts of it that have become bloated, that become inefficient. It's like the Roman triumvirate up on the Palatine Hill. They're sitting there. There's a few of these.
But they're cash cow businesses, and that's what those businesses ultimately rely on. That they'll say, well, listen, it may not be growing, but you know what? We can pretty much bend them over and generate cash flow for everything else we want to do.
But not for 30 years. When the Boston Consulting Matrix was designed, it was usually designed the cash cow would last for 4 or 5 years at best.
This is a big fat cow now.
These guys have monopolised this thing for far too long. I'm saying, but so business. businesses need to wake up and smell the coffee here. And I actually think they will for two reasons. One, and it's to do what's going on at the moment, the push to AI is a great opportunity. It's a super opportunity. But it could be even better if we could free up more resource. So what are we talking about doing there? The stuff that I'm talking about, these iterative upgrades that happen in businesses, have nothing to do with AI. They might have a label of AI. I think Larry has put has put AI on the next version of the database. I'm not sure how much AI is in there. I don't know.
He's putting a big lump of money into Stargate, so
He has plenty of it.
Yeah, he does.
Good man. You know. We're very pleased to him. But I mean, he built a super company to start out with. But I'm just saying, it's not about anything to do with what they've done in the past. It's that they're not relevant to the future. They're not relevant to the future, but they are unfortunately holding everybody back. They're holding everybody back in the potentially, you know, if you look at a 5 trillion market, there's potentially a trillion that's wasted on all these upgrades.
They don't add any functionality.
They add very little. Yeah. And there's other ways of doing it. It's not necessary. And it's all with these same organisations. So they're sucking it out. They're not efficient. They're just looking at ways to hold on to it. Wouldn't we all do that? So there's no portioning of blame here. Except on the decision makers, the business leaders, who shouldn't allow this to happen. They should say, no, we're not going to do this. Now, how do you deal with a situation where, like the one I described, version 10 to 11 in Windows, there may well be good reason for some people to go. There's lots of reasons for people to stay where they are, but they can't because there's no options, right? There's also the fact that intellectual property rights are given to Microsoft for all their products, which is correct, but it's 70-odd years. They support it for 10, maybe 12 years. What happens then? It sits on a shelf and nobody can go near it. There should be something. Something should be done about this. So legislators can help, but businesses can help by lobbying. They don't talk to legislators. I run a non-profit in Brussels and Washington. Businesses are only now starting to talk to legislators because we're bringing them in. We're bringing legislators over to meet legislators in Brussels to say, listen, will you listen to these stories? You're just focusing on consumers. The assumption at the beginning is almost always that, you know, at a legislative level, they've always taken a view historically that if you're a business and I'm a business, we can deal with each other because we can afford lawyers. And we, you know, and there's a kind of...
And you don't vote. Remember, companies don't vote.
That's a fair point, actually. I didn't think
you
of
know,
that.
Consumers are the only ones that vote. So that's all they ever have to take care of. You know?
Yeah. So they don't really step in there. But the problem you have is that, and that's fine most of the time, but actually it's not totally true either because they do create legislation in the finance world. You know, there's legislation. So they do it in the finance world to protect the countries and economies and markets, so there's good reason behind it, but they don't do it in IT. They stay well away from it, and it's now become a critical part of every business now. It's too important not to start looking at this. What can they do? But it's also important that businesses tell legislators what's going on the ground. Know, like take that 10 billion.
But do you think that businesses know what's going on the ground?
Well, this is part of the problem. The leaders, I think, personally, and I haven't met enough of them to know for sure, but some of the leaders I've met over the years, I get the impression, and when I see them on, on TV, on Squawk Box or whatever they might be, you know, CNBC or NBC, whatever, you know, you're watching them, these leaders on Bloomberg, talking about AI and the way they're talking about it, you just know they really don't know what they're talking about. They're just saying something for the market that they don't really understand. They might be in the pharmaceutical industry, they might be in the automotive industry. They don't really understand it, and that's a problem. Boards shouldn't be bringing people into the business if they don't understand it. You know, they don't. If they don't understand now, since COVID particularly, with the ramp up of technology and now with AI, it's too important. You can't abdicate. You can't sign up contracts that allow you to be shaken down through software audits. I mean, these practices are, I don't know if you've ever heard of these software audits. Software audits started in a world where it was easy to copy software because software was originally written on floppy disks you know, CD-ROMs.
Yeah, and you buy it and then you hand it to all your mates.
You can cut copies, you know. But they've got around all that now, all right? So that's it. But audits have actually increased, not decreased, okay? And what's happened is, over the years, the organisations have recognised this is a way to keep companies spending money with you. Because if we change the rules, if I change the way I license something that used to be how many people work for you, and then I change it to how many computers you have, then I change it to how many actual CPUs are in your computer, and then I change it to how many chips are on the CPU, and then I change it back again. And then I have some, then I make up a completely different way
of
building.
So it's a cottage industry after being formed.
And then what I do is, after all of that, when you're totally confused and the guy who put it in the first place is well gone, and a new guy's coming in and going, where's all the software? I have no idea. I'll tell you what now, Deloitte or somebody will arrive in the door, no disrespect to any of these guys, but that's their job. They come in and they'll do an audit. They're sent in by the... And actually, my personal view on it, it feels like a shakedown. And if you ask many of the companies who experience it, that's what they'll tell you. It feels like a shakedown.
Yeah, but there's a certain level of you know, see no evil, hear no evil, or ignorance on the part of the CEOs. And that is, you know, you have one of those big label systems in place, right? The last thing you're going to do is somebody comes into you and says, listen, the terms and conditions have changed on our Oracle database, our IBM. Do you want us to change or do you want to just accept it? And they go, oh, geez, you know, I'm not making that big a decision. So if it's all right and you think it's okay, just go ahead.
Yeah,
right?
Do a deal. And that has been the standard practice in the industry, do a deal, and that's why these numbers have just crept up and up and up. Like organisations have gone from spending, you know, if you take that 10 billion guy, he was probably spending you know, 6 billion 4 or 5 years
ago.
And he spent, like, it's the jumps are enormous. They're well above, and the amount, but the percentages haven't changed.
No.
Like, so you'd imagine, okay, if I spend, I go from 6 billion, if 90% of 6 billion was spent to keep the lights on, if I jump it up by 4 more billion, I should get all of that into innovation.
To the bottom line of my innovation P&L.
And if the 5 billion that was there before stays kind of where it is, and we can get some management over that and control over that, maybe that's okay. But that doesn't happen. Because the pace of change and the industry loves hype.
Yeah.
It loves hype. It's looking for the next...
There's FOMO there. They're all afraid of missing out on, you know, what do you mean you're only using that old system?
I mean, it was only recently was Metaverse. Before that was machine learning. I don't know. I mean, I'm in the industry and I lose track. So it is, but you have to come in then. So what does this require then? It actually requires a new mindset, actually. So it's a mindset by leaders to say, actually, hang on a second here. I'm just going to have a slightly more jaundiced position. Yeah. It's a bit like the thing where you hear it all the time. If you get it, how do you recognize something that's an email or a text that could catch you out? You know, that's going to compromise your technology or your ID or steal your money or whatever. It's anything that creates a sense of urgency.
Yeah.
It's anything that's like, I have to do this. Or
There's a deadline. Yeah.
And this is what the IT industry does. It sets deadlines. It says, this product
is gone.
Is
from
end of support. Or end of, the term they use is end of life.
Mm.
Now, what's amazing is, I'm not a technical person, by the way, believe it or not, but software is actually just a set of instructions.
Yeah.
It's all it is.
Yeah.
It doesn't even have any physical attributes whatsoever. So back to the Roman times, when Caesar was issued instructions to his forces to go into Rome, he wasn't. Those instructions still exist. They mightn't be appropriate instructions. Yeah. The thing it was written on might be gone, might have fallen apart, but those instructions do. So how can instructions have an end of life?
Yeah.
And we accept this. It's language. But they use language, they use mindset. And I actually think business leaders need to wake up to this. They say, hang on a second, we need to do something about this. The truth is, though, unfortunately, when you get into the weeds of it and you start looking at it, you might start out saying, there's not a lot we can do about it immediately. And we can't do it on our own. I was recently with a managing partner of a firm here in Ireland, one of the bigger law firms. He's since retired, and he was saying, "Yeah, we always felt we were getting a shakedown." And I said, "You're lawyers. You should be able to defend.
You should be able to spot a shakedown anywhere."
I said, "There was nothing we could do." And I said, "The reality is, there's probably nothing you could do on your own, as good as you are, as big as your organisation was, but you should have done something about it." You know, that's what you missed out on. You just assume, and this is the problem, I guess, as well, is that boards the change in I'm only going to be there for 5 years, so but do I really want to take on that fight?
Right, yeah.
So there is a challenge there. Who is up? Who really wants to take this on? If I'm, you know, the CEO of a bank and I'm in the UK, all I'm thinking about is, am I going to get a peerage from, or a CBE or an OBE from King Charles, and I'm in America, am I going to get a position on some boards? You know, and that's perfectly normal. I mean, people, they go feel they've justified with their experience and the hard work they've done. But how do you motivate people to actually make a change? And I think there's two things, actually, personally, I think that could motivate the change. One is coming from the industry itself, and one is the planet, okay? The industry itself, I'll come back to the planet in a moment. The industry itself is predicting the data. So the data center industry, let's call it, the infrastructure that's the guys who provide all the infrastructure, all the stuff sits on. I've been to a number of their conferences. I'm connected with a lot of the leaders globally in this world, and they are saying that over the next 2 years, there's going to be a doubling of capacity required from an energy, water consumption, and just footprints. And we're seeing it. It's all over the newspaper, and they're getting a lot of bad press about it as well.
Yeah.
Okay. That could go within 4 years. It's going to double again. Potentially. So something in 4 or 5 years is going to double again.
Yeah, yeah.
The issue is, where are they going to get all the critical raw materials? Where are they going to get all the power? Mm-hmm. Particularly in a world today where actually we're seeing a lot more climate impacting power outages, just as consumers we see it, but we're going to start seeing it in data centres. It happened in Cuba, the entire island of Cuba was taken out. Never happened before. Mm-hmm. You know, usually the military and the governmental pieces are still put a hold okay. Everything went. So we're going to start seeing more and more outages. And the industry itself saying the problem is that's going to create capacity constraints. And there's a potential that the demand and the capacity constraints are going to intersect. And that the impact is going to be that at that point where we can't deliver, this is what the industry is saying, we can't deliver
The capacity, or
the operational resilience. It's not about the capacity, actually. It's about guaranteeing that you're going to be up.
Up, yeah.
So to guarantee up, it's not what you're using. It's how much other stuff have I got, and where is it that it can take over in case I have a problem here. Yeah.
So the redundancy in the system.
Yeah. So if you have a capacity of X, you might need 4X or 5X just to be able to be guaranteed. If anything happens, we're always on. And that was the promise IT gave business and has delivered on. Regardless of all the issues I've been talking about, it has delivered on that. It has delivered, despite some challenges over the years, it has delivered. But actually the industry itself saying they are not going to be able to guarantee the operational resilience, potentially. So that's the first thing. If that's going to happen, what is that going to mean for business leaders who used to say, how much more money do you need?
It's not a question of money anymore.
Well, you see, now what it means is that the terminology they use, you might have heard of the five nines terminology. So the terminology they use is that five nines is you're going to have potentially some downtime, but you're going to know when it is and it's controlled, right? Okay. Go to four nines. You're going to have some downtime. It's going to be for longer, and I can't tell you. It's the Donald Rumsfeld spelt. The known unknowns. You know? And this is the problem. So that, I think, is the first thing that's going to happen. Now, it's only a speculation. It's a forecast. Mm. How serious people are, I would look at that seriously. If the insiders are talking about this, as a CEO of a company, that's a concern of mine, and that should be a concern of every CEO out there. And we should be talking to each other, and the board should be looking at this, saying, actually, this is a real issue here. Do we want our banking platform down or our shopping platform going down on Black Friday?
Because
we don't know when it's going to go down. It may have nothing to do with throughput. So this is not connected with load.
Yeah.
This is just connected with actually, I can't give everybody what they want.
When they want it.
And it's as simple as that. Or there'll be kind of the thems and the usses, you know. Yeah. You can pay more than me and jacks the price up. Yeah. And so suddenly the whole thing...
Dynamic pricing. We've heard dynamic pricing.
Did you get your tickets?
I did. So... Back
to the sustainability one afterwards. But
in terms of the original proposition then? Where does it fit in that type of a world that you've described?
Yeah, so where we fit in is we help companies extend the life of the technology. They do not have to upgrade under our service. So they have a version of software, they can run that forever. We can secure it, we can keep the regulator happy. And in fact, we can actually make changes to it. Not by touching the source code, because we didn't write the code, but software plugs in. People always use software together.
Yeah.
So if you need something, we've customers using the same, you know, business intelligence applications in America, you know, Valvoline, a customer of ours. They're still using, they're actually owned by Aramco now, but 10 years ago, they started using us, and they've since moved it out into the cloud, and they've done loads of different things with the exact same version.
Right.
Direct Line Group in the UK, exactly the same. That they came to us 10 years ago and they haven't had to change any of the software that we support.
The issue here is actually then, if I'm thinking about it right, actually it's not about a mainframe to cloud thing, move, if you will. It doesn't matter whether it's mainframe, doesn't matter whether it's actually the version of software that there's nothing wrong with, but just needs support. It's a bit like having an old car. You still need to bring it to the mechanic and do whatever necessary. Yeah. But the dealership that you bought the car off has sold you, I ain't servicing that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. But you could change the seats.
Yeah.
You could change parts of the engine. You can change the steering wheel.
Yeah.
You can change everything in the car. The car doesn't have to be exactly the same.
Same, yeah.
You know what I mean? So you can still run the car. It's about that. Did I need to change the entire car? And in the car world, you don't see the risk with that. Mm. But in the IT world, the biggest issue here is not just the cost of doing this. Mm. It's the risk. You know, we have a customer in the US who's an insurance company, and they were looking initially to change their claims application. And claims application sits at the back end. And during the discussions, they were saying they don't really want to change it. I said, do you really want to change the claims application? Why would you change it? Surely, you know, what you need in the insurance business is if the customer has an accident or something, wants to do a claim, they want something in their phone, a camera to record the crash and do an automatic upload and send a calculation of a claim and do it all on the spot. And they can just do it through very simply.
Yeah.
But that's just the front end.
Yeah.
The actual calculation of the claim is probably not going to change massively.
No.
You know? So why would you change the claim? And they were talking about spending $150 million on the thing. And they were also saying it's going to take probably 18 months and all the risk and the distraction. And we had dinner. They were in Dublin. They were they were passing through the senior leadership. And I said, why would you bother doing that? And we were having pints in Ranelagh. And I said, we were joking about it. You don't need to do any of this. Why would you be doing this? This is a debate. Mm-hmm. They go back to the States. They ring us about 2 or 3 weeks later to say, that was a really good idea. Mm-hmm. We'd like you to come over. So we flew over to the US, myself and Rowan, to meet them. That's Rowan O'Dunham, my co-founder. We both flew over to the States and we sat down with them and came up with a plan. Now, I'm simplifying it for effect, but actually it was relatively straightforward. It was just a matter of saying, okay, You know, we have to cover this bit, we got to cover that bit. That does need to be changed because there's some physical bits that need to be changed, or it's physically located here and we got to get out of that building and we're putting it over to this place or whatever. You know, okay, so but they're just considerations.
The logistics in it.
They're just considerations. Yeah. And what happens is the industry goes, there's DORA regulations and which there are, but that doesn't mean you can't meet them.
No.
Or there's PCI compliance. Like, they throw all this nonsense speak, thinking that they're the most intelligent guys in the room. What are you talking about? Mm-hmm. What do you actually ask? When you're talking about regulations, yes, there are regulations. And we have regulation experts in our business. And we look at this and say, how can we meet the regulations doing it the way we do it? Mm. And you can, absolutely. Why don't companies do it? Why don't businesses do it? Do you know why they don't do it? Because turkeys don't vote for Christmas.
Yeah.
And IT leaders, that's why the business leaders need to step in here. There's some super IT leaders out there, but most IT people don't like what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Because it probably removes their modus operandi almost.
Yeah.
You know?
I wouldn't be very well liked by IT people saying what I'm saying to you now. Yeah. But genuinely, because...
But there's the other thing too is, and I'm sure everybody listening has had this experience, right? You move over to a new version of software on your phone. It tells you need a software update. It moves over, right? And there's always problems with the new software.
Yeah.
And you're then saying, oh, a patch will be sent out. You don't have that problem with old software because it's gone well and truly road tested, right? So, you know, you would think to say to people, look, it's not broke, don't fix it. Can it be modernised? Yes, it can, but it doesn't have to be changed.
Yeah, and it isn't one size fits all either, but you're absolutely right. Mm. What you need to do is examine, like the classic example of one that's been a high profile is Sonos.
Mm.
So they fired the CEO. They rolled out, was it like a year ago? They rolled out, or less than a year ago, they rolled out the new version. It's been a disaster.
Yeah.
Now, yes, they needed a new version, because that's a kind of an app that does require. So some apps need, it's a front end.
Yeah.
We can't be all looking at the same, on our new devices. Mm. You want to be looking at something that's sexier. So there's a reason you might do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But then there's how you do it. Yeah. So that example was just a really poor execution of it. But probably lots of the back end doesn't need to be changed. So it's about the balance. And I just think sometimes we lose the balance. Mm. We've given too much trust to all of the consultants and the companies themselves that make the software and all these outsourced companies who then say, oh, we'll take the problem away. And the minute they take it away, there's a problem as well.
Because you lose control. You as the business owner lose control over what's going on.
Well, also the companies that took it on usually have already losing money the year one and trying to make money.
Yeah.
So you know, because they took it on as a last leader to get the deal over the line and signed a 10-year thing. Yeah. So the day one is... So these are kind of... And they're all in the same... And they all have these supply chain costs.
Yeah.
And all have supply chain challenges because it's written in the contract, we've got to give you this, this, and this.
Yeah.
So they have to do, and also they make money through these upgrades because they're change control and change management processes. Oh, well, you have to move to that, so we'll do that. It wasn't included in the contract. So we kind of want you to do it, but there's no benefit.
Hmm.
And so they're claiming that you're bringing everybody to the new age. They're really not. No. They're just bringing you around the corner.
Yeah, and emptying your pockets along the way.
Yeah.
Talk to me about operating as a David in a David versus Goliath. The pros and the cons of this.
Yeah, it's great fun. It's great fun because you're just out there. You can nearly say what you want. Mm. I don't have to be politically correct. I don't have to be hold back. And so that's the fun part, and I can be myself.
Hmm.
I guess I think I was. This was always in me as a young fella.
Right.
I was always somebody that wouldn't
spoke his mind, but should have known better in some cases.
Yeah, plenty of time. That's the kind of fun part. The downside is obviously it's very hard. Hmm. It's even the conversation we're having there. Who the hell are we? I mean, a CEO of a company, even in Ireland, would go, who's your man?
Yeah.
Never even heard of this company. Never heard of this guy. If they Google me, all they'll find is the ex-Irish rugby player. You know what I mean? You can't even find me. Go, never heard of this guy. So what is he talking about? And that's the downside. And it's not that I want everybody to know about. And I don't think as an individual, I am going to change. We have a phrase in our it's a vision of our company, is to change the software world, and we're genuinely, that's what we'd like to do. We want to change the industry. We don't actually expect that we alone are going to change the industry. That may happen, it may not happen. I don't know. We're growing, but I'm not sitting there going, I'm going to change the entire industry just by myself. All right, that's not what I'm saying here, but I'm saying I could be part of that. And I actually know there are, because I spend a lot of time traveling and meeting people in all sorts of positions. And I know actually when I talk to them about this stuff, the way we're talking, a lot of people get it.
Yeah.
The only people that don't get it who have a vested interest, who want that project to happen. Mm. But actually, if they step back and say, this is actually not good, there'd be far, if we freed up some of that money or all of it, if we could free $1 trillion out of the $5 trillion, we still spend $1 trillion.
Yeah,
we just spend it differently. So, okay, now the downside, some people will...
And the margin and utility will be much better on that.
Totally.
And
you get much more innovation.
Yeah.
You got the DeepSeek thing that happened recently. Mm. That's a classic example of people just being clever.
Yeah.
Just being clever, using what's already there. That's what we need.
Mm.
And that, some of that's been driven through geopolitical challenges between China and America and everybody else. It's that competitive streak. But actually, if there was more money there available, you'd get more innovation. And you'd get it here in Europe. And you'd get it here in Ireland. And you'd get it, that's what we want. We want it on our doorstep. There are very few European companies playing in this game.
Yeah.
bringing new technology out, it's invariably going to be US or China. Mm. We're not at the game. And in Ireland, we have a super industry, yeah, and we're small, but we're part of the European ecosystem. Yeah. We'd like to be surrounded by really powerful that are on their doorstep. We don't have to keep getting transatlantic flights. Mm. Wouldn't it be better if they were either in the UK or in France or in Germany or in Italy or Spain or anywhere in Europe? You know, that would be much better for us. And I think you'd end up with that, because if we free that money up, and one of the conversations we want to have with legislators is that Brussels needs to say, well, maybe we can do it here. If in this geopolitical world, we can change the rules.
Yeah.
Let's make it happen.
We have that ability to do it.
Well, you know, if everyone's going to be fighting with each other, if Trump's just going to come out with something that's going to say, we're going to do this in America, well, why don't they do that in Europe then? Mm. Right, we'll just say, actually, if you want to support that product, and if you're withdrawing support, we insist that you keep support, or actually we're changing our laws around intellectual property rights. Now, we wrote a paper on this actually a couple of years ago with a lawyer out of Paris, Dan Shefflett, who's one of our advisors, a very interesting fella, and I'll tell you about him another day, but super intellectual guy. He helped us write a paper to bring to Brussels. Now, we don't expect Brussels to start changing the intellectual property rights, but there's a lot of merit in actually maybe adjusting it to say, for technology, why don't we have
use it or lose it type?
Well, or maybe it's a slightly shorter, it's technical intellectual property as opposed to artistic.
Yeah.
You know? And the artistic one is longer and is as it is, and the new one is maybe 10 or 12 years, and at the end it expires. Because that's all they're using for anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know.
But like, the thing about it is, like, it's not that far of a stretch to think about it, because like you think about patents on drugs, they're 20 years and then that's it. And anybody, they want to come in and produce generic drugs on the same one as that. So why should software be 70 years in terms of a license or something like that?
Because that's what they did when they set it up originally.
And that's the crux of it, though. You know, if somebody asks, well, why does it have to be? The answer can't be, well, that's always the way it's been, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you there. I'm totally with you.
When it comes to the business, right, in terms of when you formed the business, Did you see it as, I suppose, was your mindset, listen, I really want to start a business and this is a good thing I could do, or there's a real problem here that I think I can solve, and if there's a business generates out of it, great, I'll have found something.
A bit of both, actually, to be honest with you. So I had been in the industry for many years. I had worked in IBM. As a young sales guy, I left at the age of 27 and started a value-added reseller, was the term, it's the Irish market. And I was in the ecosystem of IBM. That's how I ended up with doing IBM technology. So I used to see, and myself and Rowan used to talk about this when we were together, with going, what's the value of people getting from these contracts? Mm. And we actually resold some of them, not all, to all our customers, but occasionally we'd resell them. And the customers would be asking us, what are we getting for this? And we'd sometimes actually sell a contract on top of it so they could actually call us, because they really liked talking to us. And we'd have the rights to upgrade or apply patches. Because at the early stage of software, this stuff was totally necessary, because, you know, software engineers would sell you a product that they knew would break. Mm-hmm. They'd never do it, actually, a civil engineer would not build a bridge that they know was going to collapse.
Crack.
But that's the nature of, the software industry. It started that way, you know, and there's a lot of engineering in it, and user testing is a critical part of the process. So at the beginning, you kind of needed all these contracts. Mm-hmm. But you fast forward, even when we were starting the idea back in 2012, or even before that, it was about 2009 when I first kind of was looking at this stuff. And I was thinking, this is mad. And I came across a paper it was a financial paper about a company in the US that had started doing this in the world of SAP and Oracle. Mm-hmm. And the paper was about the stock price of SAP and Oracle, that in a normal market, that when a player like this company comes into the market, that actually you will find that actually they will open up competition, it's going to be good for competition, and then their stock price is too high. They were completely wrong. Mm. What they missed was that in the first instance, that company actually made a boo-boo at the start, In terms of messing around with intellectual property or the licensing terms of Oracle software. Mm-hmm. And then Oracle took them to court, checked with all the way to the US Supreme Court, so it held the industry back, but also didn't recognise the way the industry operates, as we were talking at the top of the podcast. There's a level of control here that the suppliers have over the market that's totally unbalanced.
Yeah.
So, of course, the stock price is going to continue to grow in that environment. Of course it is, you know. So I saw this company and I said, look, I wonder, is there an opportunity? Didn't think a huge amount about it. And at around 2011, my relationship with IBM as a partner was terminated by IBM. We didn't do anything wrong. They had every right to terminate. It was a 90-day termination clause without cause. They were rationalising their channel, let's call it. But we were like Bill Cullen, like can't sell Renault anymore, you know. So suddenly we were in trouble. We had to go and figure out what we were going to do. And actually, it was the making of me as a business person, to be honest with you, because actually the truth was I never really liked what I was doing.
Mm.
You know, we were making good money, and I'd bought a house, and I was married, and my beautiful wife, and my lovely daughter, and everything was. But I wasn't happy at work. I didn't like work. Mm. You know, I wasn't happy at work. And I saw, obviously, I had to knuckle down and save the business and figure out what was I going to do. And I kept going back to this opportunity. And very quickly, the customers loved us. Actually, it was amazing. I remember one of my customers said, well, can you not fix the computers that you sold us? I won't buy the IBM contract. This one guy says, and I said, and I have it here if you can figure it out. So this was hardware support. We said, well, okay, give me a week and I'll come back to you. And we spun up a data center repair business, fixing computers with all our customers. And I think only one or maybe two customers in Ireland that we had, about 40 customers at the time, and only two of them did not come with us. It was amazing. Like every single other one moved their contract. Even if it wasn't going to happen for another 6 months to a year, they committed to giving me the business, which allowed me to save the business. Had to go through best part of over a year of not paying myself, which was tricky. And I decided to go over to the UK. And I thought I was going to do the hardware and the software. And I realised actually the data center repair business was quite, there was a disconnect between fixing the computer and fixing the software, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Different people you sold to. So I decided actually, even though I was making the money out of the other one, I would just go after the software because nobody was in that game. Mm. And that, I love that, by the way. Nobody else is in it.
Yeah.
They say you can't do it and they think you're crazy. Right up my street.
Yeah.
You know, I just was like, absolutely, I'm going to prove everybody wrong.
Do you see yourself as a disruptor?
Yes, in a positive way.
Wait, yeah.
I just love the fact that everybody says you're never going to do it. Mm. So I had two lads in the business at the time, they were chairs in the business, said you're never going to do this and walked out. You know, it's mad.
Yeah.
You know, they left the company and set up their own company. And like, just as we were getting going.
Yeah.
Like they'd stuck around for a couple of years as well and they'd been looking. So it wasn't as if they didn't know. So even insiders, like the only person when I first came up with the idea, that's why we're like a married couple, myself and Rowan, it was Rowan. I went to him, I have this idea, and he goes, brilliant. Let me figure out how to deliver it because I'm not technical.
Yeah.
Like I just go, that's the problem. How do we do it? How do we do it? Well, to be fair, I covered the legal side. So I found a lawyer because remember, to do what we do, you got to do two things really, really carefully. So we're talking about it. So you have to crack what are the terms and conditions that the customer has with the owner of the IP.
IP.
You have to be absolutely clear. If you interfere in that at any stage, you're dead.
Yeah. This
is like, you know, the plane falling out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
You're the low-cost airline. They'll immediately just assume you're criminal.
Yeah.
So you've got to be totally clean. So I covered that bit. And then Ron figured out how do we do the technical side.
Okay.
And ultimately, actually, how do we do the... deliver the services with all the different products.
Mm.
There's so many products. Like they'd, you know, 800 or 900 products. Like I was going, how can we
be experts in all of this?
All of this. So we actually did it by being the experts in the license, which was the same.
Right.
So that made it easier. And then what we did is we built a model which was like what I describe as an Uber style model. You should get Rowan on the show. He'll tell you the real story. But I describe it as an Uber style model, and it's basically where we can bring in resources. The only difference is that we need multiple.
Okay.
You can't just have one guy driving the car in case the car breaks down. You
right.
need a guy beside him, and then a car probably driving behind in case the whole thing falls apart. Okay. So that's what we do, and we match to the products, to the customers, and that's how we deliver the skills.
Okay.
And we control the legal side. So we control everything that they do. So we have processes and controls that they can't, and they know when they go into a customer what their entitlements are.
Mm-hmm.
And then we know what we can't do. Because some products we take on, there's a new version comes out the next day, and you can't touch that. That's not, you know, but they will know that before they even come to us.
Okay.
So, and we'll have explained to them how we do it. So,
and then you in-source technical help where required, depending on the product.
Well, that's how we those Uber drivers are the technical guys.
Okay.
We call them global independent experts.
Okay.
So they're the experts for IBM, or they're the experts for HCL, and actually they're individual products. So if you have a product like a database, you call us. Mm-hmm. We manage. We know everything about you, and then we bring in the guy who's assigned to you as well, and he's named.
Okay.
You've already met him.
Okay.
He was there the day we took on the contract. And he's the guy, and oh, it's all right, I know exactly what Aidan has, don't worry, I'll sort you out. It means we can actually deliver a super service.
Right.
Like the service we offer is, you know, now it's not that difficult, because actually for years nobody competed with these guys, so actually just answering the, customers are saying, just answering the phone. It's not that difficult.
Yeah.
You know.
How would you describe the culture in Origina?
It's very like a family.
Okay.
I think it's competitive. It's driven. We are ambitious, but there's a, you know, people tell me regularly. I'm nearly embarrassed sometimes when they come up to me and say this is, and these people could be same age as me, maybe a year or two younger or even older, and they're coming up to me saying this is the best place that I've ever worked in my entire life, and I'm going, it's humbling actually to hear it. But I've worked really hard on that. So I've worked really hard to create a culture, and not just myself, the whole leadership team. Like, we worked to see, like, for, because I'm a kind of a student of how do you grow a business? Because it's not just about the idea. I could have any idea.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about the idea. It's that how does a company, I'm fascinated how does a company grow, and how can I grow as an individual inside the company? So when I started the business, you know, with Rowan, there was Rowan and we had two others, Linda and Bartosz, and next thing we now have, I don't even know how many people, I never count the people. I think there's, I'll ask Ross in HR, he'll tell me like there's 160 or
Ross will listen to this and he'll go, how many times have I told you there's 200 and something people in the...
yeah. But then we have a lot of affiliates, and then we have all those GIEs. So we put the whole lot together, there's probably 400 or 500
right.
in the family, you know. And we work really hard, to include people
the
outside.
The GIs that are not necessarily, so they feel part of the company, although they may not have a staff number.
They do, but they do, you know, they absolutely do. And they come over to our events and they get invited to our town halls. These are things, by the way, these guys probably never went to in their entire lives, and they could be 60 years of age because they've spent 40 years or 30 years as consultant.
Right.
So billing other companies, and now we take them on and we invite them to things. They're going, well, I'm getting invited to stuff. And, you know, they're delighted. They're genuinely really, really delighted with how, the way we do it. So the culture, I think, it's absolutely critical. And we've worked really hard to have the right sort of values in the business. So, like, we could have just drawn, what do I think are the values of Origina, and draw them up somewhere. But we actually spent, you know, a bit of time to say, okay, what actually is important to us?
Yeah.
So we kind of we put together a kind of a working group and made sure then when we got our values, which are fairness, trust, relationships, and opportunities, when we got our values, we'd measure people and reward
more
people.
Them on that basis.
So actually, every quarter, everybody who's a manager has to say, where do you fit on the scale of meeting all of these?
Okay.
Yeah, so it's, remember, only one of them is related to business.
Yeah.
You know? Well, fairness also is related to business, because we talk about fairness to customers, but also fairness to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
If people are wasting our time, you know, we deserve to get it. We're not a charity.
Yeah.
You know, so when we engage with organizations, there's got to be something.
You know,
what's coming across
quality,
the table here?
Something of esteem. I can't even remember the
parity of esteem.
Parity of esteem. Thank you very much. I think I know the answer to this one, but obviously when we look at organic versus acquired growth, there is so much opportunity out there on the organic side of it. You don't even need to think about acquired at this stage, do you?
No, I think we have to think of acquired some stage, yeah, to be honest with you. I think, not immediately, but I think it'll be acquired. And I know some people, members of my board, probably be looking at me going, what are you going to talk about, Tomás? But I actually think we need to do it at scale.
Okay.
Probably buy something that's bigger than us.
Okay.
Get to a stage where we, because I think we're never going to be relevant at 100 million, 200 million. We're going to have to go and be, you know, how do you change the software world if you're 100 million? You're not going to change anything.
No.
You know, in fact, you're probably not even going to change if you're a billion.
Yeah.
So it's not that, this has nothing to do with, genuinely, it's nothing to do with money.
Ego or vanity or anything like
that. Actually, but if you want to actually change, you have to have scale.
Mm.
You have to have some level of power. And, you know, economic power is a is an important one to have. And, yeah, I think we're going to have to get there. Now, I don't... That's the question I'm always asking myself. Can I do that?
Mm.
And I've done it to this stage, which is great. And I think I can get another do this for another couple of years. Mm. I'd love to do it the whole way.
Right.
So that would be my goal. I'd love... That's the piece I'd be very proud of myself... That if I did that, you know what I mean? And I know my wife would be. I mean, I talk about my wife, Leona. She's my biggest fan. You know, I say it about her. But she is, like, she's... And she's totally, like, she believes absolutely you could go wherever you want to go. Mm. You know what I mean? And it gives me that confidence. Even though she probably doesn't really understand in the detail what we do. But she's absolute confidence in me. And you need to have that confidence in yourself. Self. And it comes from yourself, but also comes from your family.
How do you manage, because you mentioned your board, how do you manage your board, maybe when things are going well and when things are going badly?
Well, we don't need, we're a private company.
Right.
We don't, you know, myself and Rowan, I mean, I'm the biggest shareholder and collectively the two of us, we could go around the place and say we don't need a board.
Mm.
We chose to have a board, like started 7 years ago, to put a board in place because we have always thought we were going to be where we are today.
Yeah.
In fact, I can already see where we're going to be in 2 or 3 years' time. So I have to get ready for that today.
Yeah.
So I was always getting ready for something that was around the corner, even though I couldn't completely see.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this phrase we use: our leaders need to be able to see around corners.
Right.
You know, you probably hear that in lots of different places. But we talk about that genuinely. You have to know what you don't know. All right. So we don't absolutely know, but you have to
have an idea.
Have an idea. Yeah. That's where we're going. So when we put the board in place, that was the background. We also realized that having people who could give you advice to help you was really important. Mm. Now we used to already have different advisors, and I still have. I've got my board, but I think we've got another 20 advisors across the organization who do different things. Different parts. So some are almost exclusively with me as a leader. Of a guy who's my, I couldn't think of a different name, so I call him my consigliere. So, but advice is critical.
Mm.
And we needed advice. Even though I think and I believed I could get somewhere, I didn't have time to go off and learn it.
Yeah,
I'm learning on the job. And I can't be making all the mistakes. Mm. I need somebody to tell me to watch out for this and
don't do that. Definitely do this.
Yeah, definitely do that. And we don't always have to agree, but if you're open, and I think I'm good at that, I do listen to people. Mm. I don't always agree, but I do listen to people. And if it's important enough, I'll leave it enough time and I'll think about it and I'll come back. I might initially disagree, but I'll come back and I'll go, okay, actually, so
something here.
And we've been blessed. The board we have at the moment have just done an outstanding job. My chairman, Tiernan, Ron, who was over with me in London the other day, from the Netherlands. They're just outstanding, outstanding, you know.
What's the hardest part of the job as a CEO?
As a CEO, I can only talk about me as my job as a CEO, so I can't talk about other CEOs because I've never been CEO before. My hardest job is to constantly change how I operate.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is I have to get out of the weeds. As a small company, you can be the CEO and you can still do a bit of whatever.
Yeah, make the tea and do everything else you have to.
And it's figuring out how do you get out of the weeds and to be quite strict about that with people and yourself. So it's not just yourself, because you've got to tell the people around you, because they'll give you stuff.
Yeah.
They'll be asking, oh, can you do this? Can you do that? She did it last week or last year or last month. And you're going, no, that we're not doing that anymore. We're changing. So the job is to constantly grow and to be looking for to manage that. And that's probably the biggest challenge I have. But I enjoy that as well. I mean, there's no part of the job that I don't like, actually, to be honest with you. I even enjoy when I find myself in the weeds and getting myself out of the weeds.
Do you obsess about the small things?
I can do, I guess, sometimes. I kind of work on a basis of, so if I think the small thing is going to have, it's an easy question, it's an easy thing to say, but if I think the small thing is going to have a big impact on the business, I will obsess about it. I will point it out and I'll explain why I actually think that's could have an impact.
You're not the first. But other people I've had on have said it's not about whether it's big or small, it's just whether it's important or not important.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah.
As you see it, as you look through the lens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll ignore even big things, like if it's not important, you know. But if I see a small thing and I think actually that could be impactful to the brand, to the service quality, just to or to our reputation, you know, you don't let it go. You don't let it go. And or to our values. Like if I came across a situation, which wouldn't happen now in original, but we had, actually we had the situation happen where very early on we came up with the values and fairness, trust, relationships, opportunities, and we had a problem with one of our team, a high performer on the field, but was actually not displaying the characteristics and actually stepped out of line.
I had that question here.
Okay. We had exactly that. And the amazing thing was, and actually Ross's head HR came to me afterwards and said, well done on the decision. You can imagine the decision we made. But it was an easy decision.
Yeah.
So now I had to stop to check with Rowan and with Brendan to say, do we agree this is the right decision? Because this guy does perform for us, but actually we cannot
have the collateral damage that it creates.
The damage of all, and I'm thinking of also, what do we waste our time doing all that for? Yeah. If we stand up, and we'll stand up giving out awards for all this, and then it'll be people at the back of the room, but
they still let your man.
But Johnny, he's okay, you know what I mean? Yeah, so it's all right, you could be a pain in the ass as long as you're bringing your numbers in. So we actually got rid of him, you know? That was a...
It takes a lot of kahunas to do that in a smaller business, right? Yeah. You know, when you have one of your big revenue generators that is doing that, but it's... I've yet to see a situation where it wasn't the right decision to do it.
Listen, you laugh at this. Poor Rowan has had to come to a few of these meetings with me over the years. I fired my customer. Now, I didn't fire, but I said you could go to somebody else. There were 60% of our business at the time. But they were insulting. I'm not even going to say who it was because it's not appropriate. They were insulting. They were disrespectful. They were over demanding, and they were trying to use leverage that they didn't have. And I just said, I'm not putting up with this. This was not what I got into business to do. And I remember going to the meeting, we're going for coffee with the individual from the company. I asked for a meeting offsite. And I said, Rowan, will you come with me? And it was only on the way I said to him,
by the way,
this is what we're doing. And you know what the amazing thing is? He just goes, all right.
Yeah. I said, I have the grenade in my hand. I need you to pull the pin, will you?
No, I did it. I did it myself. I'm happy to do these things myself. I'm not afraid, but you do need people to come with you on that journey, you know? Yeah.
What personal characteristic do you think is most important as the CEO?
I think, even though it's a kind of it's often used word, it's hard to describe. Leadership is critical. So, and that encompasses a lot of things. I think leadership is about, obviously, you've got to have a bit of a presence. You've got to make people feel confident that you know the decisions you're making are the right decisions. So you've got to back yourself and your team. You've got to be calm under pressure. So a good leader is calm under pressure. When the chips are down, doesn't overreact. But also knows when to react.
Yeah.
So if I was totally calm all the time, I don't think that would work either. there are times to overreact.
Yeah.
So I have a phrase I often use at home. It's like, I get the overreaction in early.
Yeah. Panic early, panic often.
Yeah. So to get the overreaction in early. And I have an overreaction sometimes to something. So if I saw it's like a minor problem, like we talked earlier, but I thought it was going to be a big impact.
Yeah.
Even though if I wasn't 100% sure, I'd probably start to have an overreaction.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Just to be sure.
Now, I think my team now, who know me well, they've been with me a long time, kind of know my modus operandi.
Yeah.
But they're still like, I guess sometimes they're not quite sure.
A bit of shock value every now and again.
They're still quite, but they see it, they're going,
What's he doing here?
Is he doing it for the shock value? But it gets people going.
Yeah.
You know, it gets people going again, you know. So I think they're critical pieces. The one, though, that I think that definitely gives me an advantage, certainly to date, is decision making.
Right.
If I was to compliment myself, that's the one I'd pick out and say, actually, because the others are probably all right at. I'm a good decision maker.
I have a question I often ask people. You know, as a CEO, you don't necessarily get better at the job, but you get quicker at making the important decisions.
Probably, that's true. That's true, 100%. 100%, yeah. So decision-making definitely is something, I say it to people all the time, it's like, it's hard to make a decision, whether it's to hire somebody or invest in a new area or, and it gets more complex as well. So you actually can't make, and so what I found as well, as the business has got bigger, is that you can't make as many decisions.
Yeah.
And actually, the decisions you make now impact, because we've brought in proper professionals into the business. Like, we've just brought in, years ago we couldn't afford them, or they wouldn't want to work for us because we're too small. So you get to a size of 50 million heading to 100 million, we're going to attract.
You're on radar.
We're on the radar from a HR perspective. You know, we get the Great Place to Work accolades, and you know, and the feedback on that is amazing. By the way, I should have said that in terms of the culture. That alone, and when we read it and see what feedback we get, it's incredible. Lost my train of thought there. Decision making. So decision making. When we look at the leaders in the business are making decisions. So when the business is smaller, you can make decisions and you can make lots of them. When the business gets bigger and you got all these professionals around you, what you miss is actually, while they're really good, if you're starting to make changes, you got to do it in a little bit more subtle way. And it requires a lot more energy from me as a person. I ended up in hospital before Christmas with pneumonia for a week, nearly in ICU. And I actually think one of the reasons I was doing was because I was still operating a little bit like the old way.
Yeah.
And I wasn't realizing that the decisions I was making were taking a lot of energy out of me. And I was then trying to do anything else.
And you really didn't need to be making... You weren't the person that needed to be making those decisions. There were others that could have made those decisions.
No, actually, I needed to make those decisions. Mm. I didn't need to do the other stuff.
Okay, all right, okay.
Yeah, I was doing stuff, still operating, like doing in the weeds, doing stuff I didn't need to do. Because I had done it a year ago.
Okay.
It's like what I said earlier, you need to get out of that stuff. And I needed to make these big decisions, and they take time. They take a huge amount of energy. And it reminded me of the thing we do. You know, they teach you, when you have a dog, we have a golden retriever at home, Louis. And whenever I could bring him for a 2-hour walk, and he'd come back and he'd be grand. He'd be sitting there going, okay, a bit tired. But if we spend 20 minutes doing mind games, hiding things around the house and hiding bits of food around and get him to go around, he's exhausted. He's exhausted in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So you can actually understand actually the power.
Power of, yeah.
The energy consumption that goes on in the CPU.
Is much greater than anything else.
You know?
Much greater than anything else. Right. Come to the final question bit. We open up the bug. I have no idea what this is.
Tell me earlier about this thing.
Hey. Oh, right. Interesting one. You have an opportunity now to thank someone who helped your career, but you never did thank them. Who is it and why?
Yes, I did. I'll try not to get upset by this, actually. Before I joined IBM, I worked in Paris in the travel industry. And I had a business mentor, a Japanese guy, Monsieur Furukawa, or Furukawa-san was his name. And I was too young, I was in my 20s. I didn't know he was my mentor. He was just a guy I was working with, and he was constantly giving me advice. He took a genuine interest in me as a leader of this company, and I was managing from, I went in young guy in the business doing a job, and within 6 months I was given 2 departments to run.
Right.
I found actually early on I was good at business.
Okay.
Wasn't academic in school really, nor college, But as soon as I got into the business world, I actually found it was better than most people around me. Mm-hmm. And I was working with a lot of Japanese, and this is back in the 90s, and I'm very competitive. And I was like, looking at the Japanese, Japan at the time was obviously the second biggest market, it's like China today. And they had a reputation for working hard. And I was like, there's no way these guys are going to work harder than an Irishman. Mm. So I determined to stay at the office later than them. And I'd go home and I'd shower and I'd get an hour or two sleep and come back in and be there before they came back
the
in.
Next day. Yeah.
Just to psych them out, right? But Mr. Furukawa was my mentor, and I didn't even realise it. It wasn't until years later I realised, and said, I better go back to Paris. And I just started this business. We were probably a couple of years. I was going over to Paris. I said, I better go and try and find him. So I met up with my old boss from the company. It was a company called GTA, travel company. And I said, do you know where he is anymore? And she said, he used to be an agent for Mizuno. He used to bring me to with other people and a group of business leaders he was working with. He had a couple of Japanese restaurants, agreed to the Paris Saint-Germain game, back before it was Champions League, it was the European Cup. He was just super. Got great advice, how to deal with Japanese people, you know, how to negotiate, what way they negotiate. And then he also advised me to take the job with IBM. When I remember when I got offered the job at IBM, I was over in Paris at the time, and I had no intention of taking it. I was just using IBM as a way to get home for a weekend to do a couple of interviews, you know. And next thing, they offered me a job, and I was like, oh God, what will I do now? And I was really happy where I was, but he suggested IBM, to go back to IBM. But when I rang, I asked for, is Monsieur Furukawa there, please? And this guy comes on the line. I said, Monsieur Furukawa, it's Tomas O'Leary here. Do you remember? He's like, no. I remember we were working at Gulliver's and GTA back. Oh, you mean my father? He died last month.
Oh, man.
I missed him by a month. Yeah, very upsetting, yeah. And he was amazing. I mean, I've had lots of mentors, but definitely, I mean,
he was foundational in a way.
He was foundational, and actually, I hope I have thanked everybody else who's helped me along the way. And there's been hundreds of people have helped me along the way. To be honest with you, I'm very lucky.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I would just like to thank my guest, Tomas O'Leary. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe, or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we will see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.